Hello, this is Simon Pegg, and you're listening to Subspace Transmissions.
Welcome back to the fleet, Discovery.
The Federation cannot stabilize while the cause of the burn remains a question.
I'm on my way to the Emerald Chain territory. If things don't go well, I'll send the ship back to you.
There's a man's life at stake. Are you in or out?
The things we do for love.
If I cross that perimeter,
we are gonna get you and everybody else.
Let's go!
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, swapping out his decon gel for his mycelial nano gel.
And we're here this week to take on the latest episode of Star Trek Discovery, Season 3, Scavengers.
You know, Cam, do you know my favorite thing is about Star Trek?
I'm trying to come up with a quippy answer, but I'm just more curious what you're going to say.
It's when characters act smart. Right? I've always said that. I love watching people be smart. Smart people do smart things. I don't like watching Star Trek characters do dumb things for the sake of plot. And it feels as if we got a solid 40 minutes of this in this week's episode.
Yeah. Burnham's reign as first officer of Discovery came to a crashing end in a way that was not particularly interesting.
No, guess what? She cried again. I'm shocked.
I actually made a note of that. I was like, oh, I thought we were going to get by in one episode, but not the case.
Nope. And she even dragged Saru down with her because he ends up culpable for not passing that intelligence on to the Admiral as well.
Yeah. I have two thoughts on this. Let's start with the first one. I feel like this whole journey to getting to Starfleet is problematic, and not in terms of like, you know, problematic, but in terms of like storytelling, and that we've been on this mission to find the Federation, to unite the, you know, the broken Federation, all this sort of stuff. And as soon as we get there, the main character of our show is like, I don't care what they're up to. I got my own thing going. And it's like, what, are we supposed to care about the Federation or not?
Well, she seems to be convinced that only she can reunite the Federation. That she says there will be no stability unless we find out what caused the burn. How does she know that?
It's a character making an assumption, and you know what they say about assumptions.
Yeah, you shouldn't make them.
That's right. Classic saying.
Okay. But, like, I just so much of her behavior aggravates me, and not her, just her behavior, the writing on the show, because ultimately, well, Burnham's decision is proven to be, you know, the right decision. So she makes the right decision, but for the wrong reasons, you know, where she's saying like, we must commandeer a vessel and go on a rogue mission. And, you know, it's just like, oh, why not just go through proper channels? You know, like she did that with Saru. What would have happened if they were delayed by 12 hours? I think Book had it down. He already had an escape plan in mind. He already had the black box in mind. Oh, yet another MacGuffin introduced out of the blue this week. I was like, as long as it's not time crystals, I don't care. But it seemed as if things would have probably worked out in the end. So it just aggravates me that this is what the writers are trying to do to propel the story forward in order to put characters in new places, such as Burnham no longer being the first officer, and she's now chief science officer. I don't know
what a journey that was. But yeah, I mean, we get to this episode, and it's like, we need the black box, guys. The black box is the key to everything that the burn has, you know, that could possibly affect us. And I'm like, what the hell's the black box? Like, what are you talking about?
I thought I missed something. Like, that, you know how, like, they kept bringing up organic sphere data last season? It's like, by then, I was just like, okay, I know what they're talking about. But here, I was just like, am I supposed to know what this black box is?
Yeah, and then there's this whole segment where they're explaining the black boxes. I'm like, wait, what? Like, I'm having flashbacks to, you know, J.J. Abrams's Rise of Skywalker, where there's like 17 different MacGuffins and the movie keeps stopping dead to explain what each one is. And it's like, guys, like, that's not storytelling. Like, I remember that movie got a lot of flack where people, you know, compared it to like an item quest, you know, like video game. And like, that's the sort of thing that, I mean, Alex Kurtzman is in many ways a protege of J.J. Abrams. And it's that sort of stuff that I feel like J.J. Abrams was getting slagged for this by, you know, film press, like years and years ago. Like, why are we continuing this trend?
I don't understand it, because I kept writing in my notes like hacky writing, you know, and it's like going back to last week, you could tell I was a little agitated about the whole Emperor Giorgio deal with her just standing frozen for like 5 seconds and nobody noticing except for Burnham. And I was just like, why not just tell us what's up? What does it add to the storytelling? And then we find out this week, like, she's having flashes to the mirror universe, which we suspected, but I would have been fine if they just gave us those flashes last week. You know, I was fine with the flashes this week. Like, it didn't aggravate me. I'm just wondering if, like I said, it's not good writing. It's not confident writing. It's hacky writing in which you think, oh, we better keep people guessing or else. And it's like that sort of stuff that's, this is far and away my least favorite episode of season 3 so far.
I think it's my least as well. But the whole sequence where Burnham is talking to Giorgio about, you know, this flashbacks, and she says, how long has this been going on? I can't remember the exact measurement of time, but Giorgio says it's a couple weeks or something, whatever it was. And now I'm like wondering, wait, how much time has elapsed since the David Cronenberg scene? Like, was she suffering from these issues before that? Like, I don't quite understand.
So at the start of the episode, Saru established that they have been undergoing refits for 3 weeks. So that seems to line up exactly with the David Cronenberg. I believe the character's name is Kovic. So that seems to line up. I think he's triggered something. This man fascinated with the Terran Empire has triggered something within her. And he also established that the two universes have been pulling apart for the last 1,000 years. So it seems as if it has something to do with her being away from the universe. And I mean that from a matter of just like quantum distances, you know? So I'm far more intrigued by what they want to do with Giorgio and the mirror universe in this situation than I ever was with seeing her play mannequin for 5 seconds last week.
Sure. The one bit of, I guess, character support for her not talking about things is that I can totally buy Giorgio as, you know, those people that will never go to a doctor. Giorgio strikes me that way.
Yeah, for sure. I'm the same, but I'm a specimen of humanity. So that's mostly why.
Well, I have to edit out all the gaps in the podcast where you just stare into space.
That's true. There are many people.
And every time I'm like, Tyler, what just happened? You're like, we don't talk about that and don't ask me again.
the journey to the salvage yard. I thought the visuals of the exterior, some of the best stuff I've ever seen Discovery do, especially when we got to see the collapse. They had those Miranda class and Oberth class classic starships, 1,000 years old now, just hanging in the atmosphere. Watching them crash down was amazing. I was impressed by the production values, but guess what? Every beat of this story, I kind of predicted what was going to happen next. And ultimately, guess what? Yes, they escaped, just as I thought they would, as I watched this entire, you know, 20-minute journey that they were going through.
I mean, I was howling to myself because it felt like they were recreating the first act of Running Man.
Yeah.
It's like, it was so similar. It was crazy. Even with the perimeters that the guy has to run away and his head explodes. I was like, oh my God, like someone likes Running Man as much as I do. This is so exciting. It's not Star Trek, but it's Running Man.
Yeah. Got decapitated and all. So I was just like, okay. The first Bajoran we see, one not wearing an earring, which I thought was interesting. Gets his head blown off. I feel sad for that bro. And it actually made me realize, not make me realize now, but it reemphasized to me that Discovery is not meant for families. And I wonder if they are willing to take the opportunity to make Strange New Worlds a spin-off series that is more family oriented, whereas Picard and Discovery can be more adult oriented. What do you think about that prospect?
I think they need something. I mean, obviously you have, Prodigy coming out for like the younger kids, but they need something. Like, why would any family going forward be like convincing their kids to watch Star Trek who aren't already, you know, loyal followers of the franchise, you know, people that have watched TNG or DS9 or whatever. It doesn't make any sense that someone who's just turning into a new Star Trek show who has young kids is going to be like, yeah, this Discovery show, I can't wait to show this to my kids.
And look, you and I, we don't mind, you know, cursing a little bit here or there, but just listening to like Tilly, you know, drop a couple S-bombs. Look, I don't mind that. It doesn't irk me, but it will, like you said, will a parent want their kid sitting there at age 6 listening to her, you know, swear like a sailor?
I mean, the swearing thing, I mean, I guess it's tough for me to really criticize considering I grew up in the 80s where like every 80s movie worked in the S word like crazy. So I watched a lot of comedies with my family with that. But to me, it's more the violence. Like the thing is, Star Trek has had violence, you know, over all the many years, but there's something about the violence in this show. When you're watching like a dude's head explode on screen, it's like, okay, this is an adult show.
Yeah, and I go back to Kurtzman interviews from years past where he was talking about creating like different series geared towards different audiences. You mentioned Star Trek Prodigy, the upcoming children's animated series. We have Lower Decks, which is kind of the young adult, you know, like adult sort of potty humor. But I think Lower Decks is fine to watch with a family. You know, Discovery, Picard, more adult oriented. That's why I feel like Strange New Worlds is their best bet for a family-oriented show. And by family-oriented, I don't mean Hallmark special, let's all give each other hugs like it's Full House at the very end, but more along the lines how you could watch TNG or TOS with your family, and I don't think anybody would feel all that uncomfortable, unless, of course, it was a Troy romance episode.
The young Tyler's favorite episodes to watch with his family.
I would demand I would tape it on VHS and make us watch it on a loop all Friday night.
They bought you one of those old VHSs of Man of the People.
Yes. It was like $80 back in the day.
That's right. An investment that totally paid off.
But I'm still running it on my current VCR.
But, I mean, we've seen Star Trek dabble in genres throughout the history of the franchise. So, like, why did this whole Prison Break episode just not really work? Is it because of the fact the way that Burnham gets there, we're already kind of against it?
That made me not want to be invested in this, because I was mad at her this entire time, because she's undermining Saru. Her whole entire argument didn't really seem to make sense. It's just like, wait a couple hours and talk to Saru some more and convince him to pass the intelligence on to the Admiral. I'm sure the Admiral will be like, okay, interesting. Like, you've got an extra ship from your friend Book. Okay, go for it, guys. You know, like, that's not going to take up our resources. This is what I'm talking about. It's like, I like it when our characters use their brains, use diplomacy, use intelligence to solve problems. But too often, and especially in this episode, Discovery relies on brute force to get your way out of a situation. And that's just not interesting to me on a storytelling level.
Well, and also, you know, obviously, as soon as she sides with Georgiou to go on this mission, you're like, I know exactly what kind of mission this is. You just know you're walking into an action movie. Like, why else would this just be the two of them going off on this mission? Georgiou was obviously going to have very, shall we say, not Starfleet tactics in a, you know, approaching this situation. So you're kind of just waiting for this fight the whole time. And I'm not going to lie, I did enjoy watching Georgiou troll that Orion dude that's running the scavenging, you know, plant or whatever it is, prison thing.
Osira's nephew of the yeah. Emerald Chain. Yes, yes.
Yeah. Like, I enjoyed watching, you know, Michelle Yeoh just, like, cut this guy down throughout the episode. That was kind of fun.
That was fun.
Although, again, once again, a villain that's kind of useless that beams away at the end and you're like, okay, I guess.
I guess we'll see him meet up with the saloon man from episode 2, right? Zara.
Are we getting the Star Trek Discovery Sinister Six?
even lamer than the Sony Sinister Six? If Paul Giamatti shows up in a rhino outfit, Cam, I am there. I am there for Star Trek Discovery.
Just start bumping that electro dubstep soundtrack.
I'm making it here at my home studio during quarantine.
Yeah, for those that don't remember, in the second Amazing Spider-Man film, those really bad Andrew Garfield ones, they tried to set up Sinister Six, and it was really embarrassing to watch.
Truly, truly embarrassing.
But part of me wonders, because the whole thing with this season, often backgrounded because we're talking so much about the Burn, but they've mentioned this whole Orion Andorian syndicate a lot, you know, right from episode one of this season. And we've already had two representatives of this syndicate kind of operating who've been, you know, villains on the show. And I really am. And we had Asyra mentioned here in this episode multiple times. I'm wondering if we're building to some sort of conflict with the syndicate later, maybe at the end of the season.
I could buy that. You know, I don't know if they've made them compelling enough in their debut so far. Although I guess, you could make an argument that in episode one, the Orion Andorian Syndicate was featured there. So, okay, they have been building them up. I'm not as gripped by them as I would if, say, there was, I don't know, the Breen coming back or something like that, where, I don't know. How are your feelings right now about Emerald Chain?
Well, I like the idea, because I always thought the Orion Syndicate were really interesting in the history of Star Trek. But I'll tell you why this particular take on them isn't compelling. It's because the lead character doesn't care about them at all.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, she had a line of dialogue in this episode that you should never make any actor say, though. She's like, she says something along the lines of, like, I need to find the source of the Burn.
I know. That was bad.
And I snickered out loud. It was the second worst usage of dialogue in this episode. The first was, it feels smooth and cool, like glass. Oh my God. People, you can't ask actors to say things like this. It's cruel.
You're giving them, like, just nothing but a failed task ahead of them. It's bad.
Really bad. Like, that's the sort of line you write. You look at it, you say it out loud to yourself as a writer, and you go, oh, no, I can't use that.
Would Cormac McCarthy ever write anything like that? Like, it's trying to use flowery language, and it's dialogue that brings attention to itself, which you don't necessarily want to do unless you are like a Coen brother or something like that, you know?
Yeah, and like, Star Trek dialogue is stylized, but not in this sort of way. Like, it feels really weird to say those sorts of lines.
Speaking of which, how Star Trek is generally stylized, the kiss and the embrace that we've all not been waiting for between Book and Burnham, they might have just had like a little pixie flying around them with like the camera swirling too, and like I wish like roses blasted out of the turbo lift. It was just like, that was like, that is not how Star Trek, which does not have a great track record depicting romance. But that just looked a little bit too Hallmark special for me.
It did. It's, again, kind of, I mean, it felt like, you know, Kurtzman and his team trying to kind of replicate that J.J. Abrams, you know, constantly moving camera. You had lens flares going on in this sequence. The one thing I'll say for it, in terms of the technique behind it, yeah, I agree, it was a little much. But the one thing I feel like saves it is that the two actors actually have chemistry. Like, I do think these two... It's the first, you know, Burnham romance. I mean, we only had one, which, as Giorgio says, was a disaster. But, you know, this one feels like it makes more sense and they actually click.
I agree with that. I just don't know. Look, you and I discussed, you know, from the outset, like, we don't mind if they get together. I'm glad they're not doing the will they or won't they, dragging that out for an entire season. I just don't know how invested I am, not in these characters, but in their romance and what that's going to mean for the series going forward. I think what it's going to mean is a lot of predictable tension that could otherwise have been avoided or be resolved if they simply weren't in a romance. And I know what you're thinking. Well, isn't that supposed to be the very definition of drama? You know, interpersonal conflict? Yeah, but I can't imagine them getting anything too juicy out of this. Even with Tyler, at least we got the Voke revelation, but that was a lot of boring ass sort of dates that we had to sit through leading up to that.
Yeah, my big worry is they're going to present this as sort of an alternate lifestyle that Burnham could pursue, and that will be the conflict by the end, is her having to choose between Discovery, which obviously there's a lot of conflict going on with her and the Discovery mission, you know, or a life with this guy, and like the season will end with like a tearful goodbye to him as she chooses Starfleet, because no one really wants to tune in to watch the Book and Burnham show.
I'm far more interested in just watching partners that seem to like each other and have good chemistry. And I think back to like two particular scenes in which we have Stamets and Culber once again in pajamas. It's been way too long since we've seen them in PJs, but they're just sitting there and they're talking to each other, which I appreciate. And it's Stamets coming around and how, yes, he can actually be a decent mentor to Adira. And then we also have Adira and Gray interacting briefly in mess hall as well as engineering. I like those moments much more, where they don't have to like just draw all this attention to these sweeping camera movements and, you know, that sort of stuff. Like I just like people being normal in relationships rather than like the swelling orchestral music that you get from melodramas.
Is it hard, do you think, for them to sustain a romance in this sort of Star Trek show with a character who isn't in Starfleet? Because when I look at Deep Space Nine, they pull it off great with Cassidy Yates. But the fact of the matter is that's a stationary show where it's not them going on missions and continuing onwards. Whereas I feel like on these ship-based shows, that's a very difficult thing to write, to keep that other character around.
Well, I'd like to point out one of the most successful, Starfleet, non-Starfleet relationships in Star Trek canon, Cam.
I think I know where you're going, but go ahead.
It's called a little something known as Seven of Nine and Chakotay. There you go. Just totally turned your argument on its head.
Totally. I stand completely corrected and humiliated.
Yes, yes. But I agree with you. It's just like, don't we kind of think that they're inevitably going to have to break up? They're going to be forced to break up probably by the end of the season?
Unless he joins Starfleet, yes.
Will he? I don't know. He might. What's his job on the ship?
Cat expert. I don't know.
Okay. No. He takes over for Burnham as number one.
That'd be amazing. Sure. I mean, his whole thing is like animals, so I don't know. Maybe in biology? I don't know.
Okay, sure. I don't know. It's like, I don't see a role for him in Starfleet, though.
No, that's why I really am worried this is going to build to the conflict between choosing between a life with Book and a life with Starfleet.
What does she ultimately choose? The star of Star Trek Discovery, Cam?
Yeah, that would be amazing if she didn't choose them. And then they just change the title to next, like for next season.
So I tell you what, I've been reading this book. It's called The Soprano Sessions. And I've been reading it along as I've been going season through season of my rewatch of The Sopranos, which I finished a few weeks ago. But the end of the book features a transcribed interview between the authors and the creator of The Sopranos, David Chase. And they're talking about this one particular event, and they're talking about how, don't you think so-and-so could have slept with so-and-so, leading so-and-so to kill him? And then the creator is like, yeah, isn't that what everybody expected? That's why we didn't do it. And I'm just like, yes, don't, like, if the audience can predict everything that's going to unfold beat from beat, then don't do it. Like, turn those conventions on their head there. Like, that's why the whole prison break thing did nothing for me, is because I kind of knew how it was inevitably going to end. They're trying to create tension from, like, making us guess how they're going to get out of this situation. But I'm way more interested in Saru coming down to engineering and talking to Tilly about whether she knows where Michael might have gone. And Tilly goes ahead and tattles on Burnham and doesn't even back her up. Like, she says to Saru, you have to tell the Admiral now. And he's like, I thought you were going to be the one to talk me out of it. This is my favorite moment of the show, because this is actually about character stakes and interactions and people realizing where their loyalties are. It's not about like shooting people with phasers or blowing heads off. Like, that's not the stuff that really draws me into Star Trek.
Yeah, I agree 100% with that, because those moments, and we'll maybe delve into those a little more in a second, but like those conversations between, you know, Saru and Burnham, I really enjoyed the Tilly and Saru talking to each other. You know, Stamets and Colbert talking to each other, all of this stuff, I really enjoyed a lot because, again, the show understands its characters. It's when it does these, like, these things I don't care about, quite frankly. Like, once again, we've got characters talking about, you know, triangulating coordinates to something or other. And it's like, yeah, I know. I remember doing this to find Spock last season. It wasn't interesting then. It's not interesting now. Like, come on, guys. Like, focus on what works. It's really annoying.
Well, what works, what we say consistently every week is the character beats, like the characters interacting with each other. And we say it season after season, plot is not Discovery's strength. And I just wonder if they would lean more into what works for them. And I just don't get the sense that that's what they're going to be doing yet again this season, though, that they're going to lean more into plot as we go further. And they're going to keep saying, what is the burn. And the mystery of the season sort of stuff, that this formula that they've fallen into, it really hasn't worked for me any season that they've tried it out.
I mean, the thing is, you can understand if they made it an action-based show because maybe the characters weren't really there, or the writing for the dialogue wasn't really there. You know, there's a lot of lower-tier action shows or some of these superhero shows where obviously they're putting a lot of the focus on the action scenes or the villain of the week or whatever because, you know, things are a little stiff otherwise. But with Discovery, the show comes to life every time the characters are talking to one another or engaging in, you know, a debate or something along those lines. It's like, it's all happening right in front of the creators. And yet they're like, no, forget that. The burn. It's all about finding coordinates, damn it. We care about these coordinates. It's like, no one cares about them, guys. No one cares.
Well, maybe we could get into some of the stuff that worked more for us. Before we get there, I know, listeners, it's not usually super fun to tune into a podcast for a show that you like and just listen to the hosts drag on it. But I think our critiques are legitimate. The reason we're delivering them is because we like the show and we wish it would kind of improve on some very obvious flaws that I think could be fixed quite easily. But Cam, we are approaching the halfway mark of the season, which, holy moly, it's flying by for me at this point. But how do you feel about Discovery Season 3 at just about the halfway mark now?
I feel like it's been a disappointment because, I mean, when season two ended, that finale really had me convinced we had something really special coming. And one thing Star Trek Discovery has done in the past is that it's a slow burn. Like the first six episodes or whatever, seven episodes, really take a long time to get to something. And I was thinking by the end of that season, you know, two, I was thinking, okay, we are not going to do that anymore. It feels like this show's confident. It knows what it wants to do. And we're going to be sprinting from now on. And I don't mean sprinting as in racing through episodes, which Discovery also has a bad habit of. But in terms of just like confidence and going, okay, we know what the strength of this show is. Let's go. And it doesn't really feel like that at all.
Yeah.
It feels like they're falling into the same habits they were last season. And I enjoyed last season, but it's just, I was more forgiving last season because season one was such a mess. And there was obviously problems at the start of season two as well. But this time I'm like, I don't understand. Like, you had a set team. Like, why? Why, people? Why?
I'm falling into the same trap that I did. Not a trap, but I have the same criticism. And just as I did not really care about the Red Angel mystery at the halfway point of season two, I don't really care about the burn mystery at the halfway point of season three. And I think the writers kind of made the same mistake yet again, as they did not establish the stakes early enough in the season as to why this matters. Like, by the time you get to the end of season two, they finally start to establish why the Red Angel is important. I'm just like, why don't you just do that at the start? Like, then we'll be less frustrated as viewers, though, I'll tell you why, though. It's because they want to keep it a mystery. And you don't need to have everything to be a mystery to make people tune in week to week, to make it compelling. People tune in because they like the characters and they like what's going to happen next to these characters. And if you just told us what the burn was from the start and let our characters figure it out, I know that leads to like yet another narrative problem in which our characters seem dumb if the audience already knows what the solution is. And so we're just getting frustrated with our characters not being able to figure it out. I just think that they keep digging themselves into a hole with this mystery box storytelling that they seem so fond of.
Yeah. As people who listen to this podcast for a long time know, I'm a fan of the James Bond franchise. And I think a lot of people would agree with me that the James Bond franchise struggled a lot when it transitioned from episodic to serialized storytelling in the films. And I feel like Star Trek is undergoing a similarly bumpy journey, and that, you know, they went all in from season one Discovery in a way that has felt kind of unnatural and awkward and hasn't delivered the best of what they're capable of. And, you know, the same was with the Bond franchise. And the problem is we're a lot harder on it because we look at shows like, say, The Mandalorian, which is doing a serialized Star Wars story and is doing it so much more confidently that we go, well, come on, Star Trek, why can't you do that? But it seems like there's some sort of glitch that both, you know, the Star Trek people, the Bond people, and I'm sure other franchises out there just can't quite crack.
I think it all comes down to, you know, keeping it simple. Like, that's all you have to do. And like the Mandalorian is gripping fans in a way. Is there much, I'm totally oblivious to this, Cam, but is there much Mandalorian hate going on the interweb, as the kids call it nowadays?
No. You'll hear the odd episode. People are like, oh, this one wasn't as good as the last week's. But other than that, no, like people do not seem, you don't get the hostility you get towards, you know, Discovery. I thought it was interesting. I just logged into IMDb, as I do for all of our podcast episodes, to have the cast list in front of me. But I see like this episode got pretty low ratings so far. So as compared to last week, which actually got quite high right out of the gate. So it's obvious that like people with, you know, who are just rating Star Trek Discovery episodes, they do very much swing wildly on the show, which is not the case for a show like, say, like The Mandalorian, which seems very consistent across the board. Like people are mostly content week to week.
Well, maybe I'll use that as a segue to talk about some of the things that I did like in this one. Is Linus meant to be Discovery's answer to Baby Yoda?
He is adorable. You just want to snuggle with him.
I like, I'm a cheap laugh. I did get a couple chuckles out of him just randomly transporting into rooms by accident because he hasn't figured out his 32nd century comm badge yet.
Great, great running gag. Like, that's the sort of thing you would have seen, like a Data gag throughout a TNG episode. I'm like, again, this is the type of Star Trek storytelling that really works. Like, people love the character stuff, especially when it's funny or, you know, has kind of that family vibe. And we're getting that there for sure. I loved it.
Yeah. I also like kind of the new consoles, the new comm badges, the detaching nacelles. Like we've been speculating about it. I think you may have even mentioned it in like the season two finale podcast episode in which, well, what do you expect for technology upgrades for the USS Discovery moving forward? And it is legit stuff that I think works. It makes sure that it doesn't seem as if it's a Viking ship trying to fight in a 21st century Navy, you know? So I thought those were some cool moments. Although all the secondary bridge crew going, whoa, gnarly, man. Like that kind of made me like roll my eyes just a little bit.
Playing air guitar like Bill and Ted.
Yes. at least Reese has his first character trait.
That's right. I did wonder though, you know, when they're showing the badges and that the badges now act as tricorders and pads and all this sort of stuff, I was like, boy, I feel like Star Trek merchandising opportunities are shrinking with this show.
Yeah, unless those comm badges are very good at recreating holograms, which will cost maybe $3,000, I don't know where they really go from here in terms of Star Trek merch from the 32nd century.
And also, a lot of what fans love about Star Trek is these tactile things. You know, you see fans at conventions buying tricorders, buying communicators, all that. Does it, like, rob the franchise of something when you're just removing all that from the equation? Kind of the fun of seeing characters handle these physical props on screen.
It's the tactile stuff. And another moment that I enjoyed was just watching them walk around the salvage yard talking about, you know, self-sealing stem bolts or even Giorgio digging out that 24th century TNG era phaser. We also, did you see her like twirling her fingers in a pile of like old Starfleet and Klingon insignia comm badges there?
Yeah, that was cool.
Does that not remind you of like my stash that I have here at my place?
It's quite a vast collection. Yes,
I am proud of that. So from what I understand, though, it's QMX had the license to do all those, and what I believe is that that license has lapsed. So it's not going to be QMX as the merchandiser going forward. So I am curious what the new who will be doing the new 32nd century comm badges, as well as the Star Trek Picard comm badges, because I'd like to get life size versions of both of those.
Yeah. Were there any kind of specialty Lower Decks badges?
Oh, so I'll tell you something that I have put on my Elfster. For those that don't know, that's kind of the online Christmas list that you can pass over to your loved ones so that nobody copies like a gift that you want. But Fan Sets has created a two-scale magnetic Lower Decks comm badge. It looks like the comm badge that they have on Lower Decks. I don't know, that delighted me, so that I threw that on my Elfster as well.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Yeah. I'm surprised that they would let a license like that lapse, or it just seemed like such a successful formula, and I can't imagine why that both parties wouldn't have wanted to sign up again.
I don't get it, because those QMX badges are gorgeous. Like, Cam, you've seen me wearing them. You see me walking around on dates with them on, right?
That's right. Every date. It's more like, instead of looking at what outfit you're going to wear, you're like, which badge am I wearing? Am I a cadet? Am I a captain? We'll find out.
Well, it's the same outfit every date, because I'm dressed as Will Riker TNG era uniform.
Except from Genesis, where he's a caveman.
For listeners that may not recall, Cam, I literally did dress up as Caveman Riker from Genesis for one Halloween. And yep. You can back me up here. At the bar we were at, no one knew what the hell I was supposed to be.
That's correct.
It was kind of disheartening. And I literally, during the costume contest, I got booed off stage. And I believe you won, did you not?
Yeah, I did. Yes. Yes, I did.
You were Nightcrawler from the X-Men.
That's right. Yeah, they were big fans of Nightcrawler there. And yeah, I think I got a $100 gift certificate to that bar and grill. Yeah.
Did you ever use the entire gift certificate?
I think you and I went and got pizza or something.
Okay.
I think we went back and I seem to recall, I think I covered everything just with that certificate, because it's not like we went there very often anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Well, hopefully COVID hasn't put that gift certificate underwater for now.
Yeah. But look, getting back to things I like, I thought the Saru Burnham dialogue was great. Like, I love whenever we can have, you know, heart to hearts between these two characters. You know, I think, of course, from, you know, Obol for Charon, where he's on his deathbed talking to Burnham. Even the earlier season one stuff where there's a lot of conflict and tension between them. I like these two characters having a relationship that kind of has its ups and downs. The only thing I worry about is, you know, when I look at all the past Star Trek captains, if you were to like really do something like that, you know, really put their command in, you know, jeopardy, there would be fireworks. I think of Archer just ripping into Trip, his close buddy Trip, you know, in the Cogenitor. Like, Saru never does this. And I'm just wondering if the show is making him seem weak just by having a main character that just keeps doing the exact opposite of what he says to do.
Well, last week, our guest, Janine Smith, your sister, she was talking about how she kept rolling her eyes whenever I was singing the praises of Saru as captain this season, because she said that he just doesn't have that kind of anchor quality that, say, one Lorca or Pike did. And moments like this, I get what she's saying. Like, I am just like, yeah, he does look kind of feckless in these situations. I even wrote in my notes, you know, how long does Saru let Michael get away with all of this? And well, by the end, like, she gets a bit of a dressing down. She's allowed to, you know, still serve aboard the ship, but she doesn't get to be number one. But then she pulls her own comm badge off and just stares at it longingly. And I'm just like, yeah, just it kind of frustrates me, even though I like Saru as captain.
The worst part too was he, you know, strips her of, you know, her first officer, you know, assignment, boots her back down to science, and, you know, he's walking away and she goes, Saru, you did the right thing. So we now have Burnham confirming to Saru he did the right thing. Like, this is not a captain with any confidence, it seems like, at this point.
or even any agency, because Burnham essentially takes, from a storytelling perspective, Burnham, the main character, takes all the agency away from Saru in that moment by saying, like, you're right, I was wrong. And it's like, it's just like, the writers are, they know that Burnham is the main character, she's the lead, but they keep making her do dumb things for the sake of plots, or doing frustrating things that aggravate me as a viewer for the sake of plots. But they ultimately want to kind of validate her decisions. And that kind of grinds my gears.
When you think of the show Lower Decks, Mariner will do things that are wrong, that maybe save the day. But we never question whether Freeman is in command of that ship. Like, we always know that the buck stops with Freeman, because there'll usually be a scene in her office after where Mariner's getting the, you know, the riot act read to her, or a very stern talking at least. And with Saru, you don't get that. You get these like tearful, you know, discussions between him and Burnham where Saru is like this, like, I'm just so hurt by what you've done. You know, I have to be able to trust you. And it's like, okay, Saru, but like at a certain point, every captain I can think of, even the nicest one, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, Archer, pretty mellow dude most of the time. Pike, pretty mellow a lot of the time. We saw that they had fire in them. And I haven't seen that in Saru. And I think he's had plenty of opportunities where it was very well deserved to see that fire.
He even went through Vorahai.
Maybe that was the fire.
Could you imagine if her punishment was he had to shoot his little head spikes at her?
Well, yeah, like Saru, the captain who was watching, Culber and Ash Tyler beat the crap out of each other and was like, people, let's see how this plays out. Where's that Saru?
I don't know. That Saru has fallen victim to the plot contrivances of the writers and where they want Burnham to go and what they want Burnham to represent.
And then also introducing, you know, Admiral Vance, a character I'm quite enjoying, like, in the very narrow role to writing for him.
I'm sorry, Cam, you did not introduce him correctly. Whenever you say his name, you have to say Admiral Vance, Vance Refrigeration.
sorry, I apologize. Vance Refrigeration, yes. They've put him in the role now of, you know, the heavy. So, like, Saru is in this weird in-between phase, once again, where it's like, okay, Saru now has to answer to this guy. And obviously, Vance really does have that, you know, hard bark going for him. And Saru is like stuck between someone who's talking, you know, basically disciplining him, and Burnham, who's the star of the show and is overruling him on things.
I know. It's tough. For a split second, I was wondering if Burnham's punishment was that she would be booted from the Discovery, and she'd either be serving at Starfleet headquarters so Vance Refrigeration could keep an eye on her, or maybe she's tossed to another ship and she has to learn the ropes of the 32nd century ways. But then I realized, no, because one of the big deals this season is that she was separated from the crew for a year. So if it's part of the season is her being dropped into this crew after this weight being lifted off of her for a year, not carrying the burden of the universe on top of her, and her being plopped down into this rigid Starfleet hierarchy once again. So I don't know where they want to go with Burnham's character this season that I would find compelling. I found it very frustrating so far, especially when her best line is, cake is eternal.
Right. Yeah, and it's like, I like that they've managed to balance the Burnham writing. Like, I like that she has some funny lines. I like the action hero stuff when it works. I like, you know, just kind of the way this character's personality has evolved on the show, but I just don't like the way they're writing the character's actions. Like, I don't care about Burnham searching for the source of the burn. And that's all this character is talking about. Like, you know, even like the relationship with Book, it doesn't even seem like that's something that we really talk about. So much of it is tied to burn things. Like, what about either having the character just talk about maybe some selfish desires, or, you know, how they conflict with the Starfleet duty? I think that could be really interesting, but we're not getting that. You know, that's something we used to get on TNG, for example, with like Wesley debating his future in Starfleet, or, you know, other characters would go through journeys like that. what about that with Burnham, where it's just like my own dreams for my own life versus the demands of Discovery and where we are now. I've had a year away. I know what my life could be, and I'm tempted by that. But no, it's not that. It's I'm tempted by searching for the source of the burn, which is not something you ever want to have to do.
Well, season 3 finale prediction. She walks off into the sunset with the Traveler.
I would love that. What did you think of the Adira Stamets stuff in this episode?
I liked it, although I actually had to rewind at a certain point in the mess hall because I totally tuned out their incredibly trite and boring dialogue. And then I listened to it again, and I was like, yeah, it was rather boring, and it felt very kind of after-school special about... And it doesn't really move forward with thinking about the constitution of Gray, because I don't believe that it is literally Gray's soul that is haunting Adira, or it's Adira having a psychologically difficult time moving on, so much so that she constitutes a boyfriend that can literally speak to her back and forth. I'll be disappointed if that's what we find out is the case.
I mean, I'm really concerned that a lot of this series is going to be Blue Del Barrio talking to themselves, seemingly with no one off, you know, no one beside them, and other cast members just like looking at this. Like, how many times can you shoot this before it becomes like a running joke?
Well, can you imagine if Ian Alexander has a contract dispute as Gray and the writer's like, well, no problem. We can write you out really easily and keep your character in the show.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing like I'm glad that they acknowledged it was Stamets. That was one of the concerns early on was like, is this going to be like a, you know, like a Sixth Sense situation where we know right from the start that this character is a ghost? Like that sort of thing can be frustrating, but I like that Stamets understands, if not the science of this, but at least that it's a reality. So we can have other characters acknowledge that in future episodes, and we can work more on the relationship between Adira and Gray and what this could be leading towards.
Yeah. So Kim, before we get to our guest today, I'd like to ask you if you have any final thoughts on this episode.
I don't think so. I mean, I'm like Discovery so often is, it's an up and down ride. So I'm hoping that next week we rebound from this a little bit. This wasn't like Saints of Imperfection. Like that's a terrible episode of Star Trek Discovery. This was just a really weak and often frustrating one from a writing standpoint. So I'm just hoping we bounce back into something I care about next week.
The last thing I'll say is I did like Stamets's line about a tween confidant.
Yeah, that was pretty good. Yeah. I also liked the 100% rogue mission. So I'm going to start referring to myself as 100% rogue.
I'm all only at like 75% personally.
Oh, I did have, sorry, one other question. The Starfleet uniforms, we have this whole batch of new uniforms in the Federation. Do you think at a certain point we'll see the Discovery crew switch over to these new uniforms?
I don't think so. I think it is incredibly expensive. And I also think that they just, even just for marketing purposes, I think it's a bit of a leap to try to remarket your brand if you just switch the entire look of your ensemble. And I also think just from a storytelling perspective, it helps delineate the ancient crew versus the contemporary 32nd century crew. It'll be cool if we see some 32nd century Starfleet officers walking around Discovery, and we can identify them just based on their uniform.
Yeah, that's a good call. That is a good idea. Kind of like, hopefully more successful than the Makos in Enterprise. Like when you'd see a Mako walk into a scene, you mentally acknowledge them as Makos. So I like that idea of 32nd century characters walking around Discovery where we know right away visually who they are. We don't need a character to tell us. That's always a good thing.
All right, well, Cam, why don't we jump over to our guest, but stay tuned because after that, we are going to return to the Cam DeLorton Report. And beaming in with us, Cam, is a friend of a friend of the podcast. It's Steph Herman. He is actually dear friends with one of our dear friends, Carmen Bright. So that's fantastic to have that connection. She put us in touch like years ago, Steph. And so I'm glad that we can finally get you on the show. It took a while, but you're here now. We're here to talk about Star Trek Discovery Scavengers. Before we get to that, though, what was your... Oh, and I just want to thank you for joining us on the show, first of all.
Oh, I'm really happy to be here to talk about this with you guys. That's quite the opportunity.
when we have a brand new guest on, Cam and I, we're always curious about what their connection is to Star Trek, how they got into the franchise as a whole. What's your story? What led you into Star Trek?
Well, briefly, I guess I could call myself part of the Lost Generation. I got into Star Trek back when all that there was the original series episodes and a movie every couple of years. I was right in that sweet spot, right around the Star Trek II, Star Trek III, Star Trek IV. And, you know, basically fell in love with it as a kid, watching it Saturday mornings on CBC. And then, you know, of course, continue to follow the franchise as all of you Johnny Come Latelys joined in. And then just being thrilled as watching it rise in the 90s to where it sort of peaked. And then, you know, been all and continued my fandom. I mean, not always, I've always worn my fandom pretty openly, but not, you know, but kind of just always followed Star Trek, always appreciated the messaging. And, you know, always willing to give any new Star Trek a chance, and have only, you know, moderately been disappointed over the years.
Right. I'm curious, though, like, you know, you've obviously seen a lot more Star Trek since. What do you consider to be your favorite series?
You know, that's a really thorny question. And I'd like to answer it like a politician by talking about how they all have strengths and weaknesses and all of them bring something to the table. But you know what? You always sort of love the one who brought you to the dance. So when I'm looking for comfort food, I think I turn on the original series. Mm. And, you know, here's a dirty secret. Maybe I got to say, the motion picture, Star Trek, the motion picture is really relaxing and fun to watch. Even the 20-minute introduction of the Enterprise, that is like crack for my generation. We love
it. Oh, wow. I like this guy. Yeah, TOS and motion picture, you're right in line with me. Yeah.
Cam actually turned me around on motion picture. He actually got me into it. And I do appreciate it in a way that I did not before.
And I would highly recommend, if you haven't, I'm sure you guys have, but to checking out the director's cut, it tightens it up significantly, and I would say takes it from a gentleman 6 to a gentleman 7.5.
They just need a better version of it, because the DVD is very dated at this point.
You know, there are still rumors that they're going to release a 4K remaster of the director's edition. I wouldn't hold my breath, but I don't think it's a dead issue.
I hope so, yeah.
Well, now that we got you here on the show, Steph, we're moving into a Discovery Season 3. What were you thinking at the finale of Discovery Season 2 of the prospects of them zapping into the future?
I thought it was a great idea. I know that it was apparently Brian Fuller's original idea to do that at the end of Season 1. I think it opens the door to stories that you couldn't tell when you were handcuffed to continuity. I was excited to see where it would go. I was also a little worried because I have issues with Discovery, a lot of which have to do with, I think, style and writing more than any sort of particular, you know, a lot of the specific fan gripes I'm seeing, not really bugging me too much. I just want there to be strong writing and good characters.
Well, Cam, it sounds like Steph is cut from the same cloth as we are at this point.
Yeah, no kidding, no kidding. And have you been able to, you know, with these obvious issues, you know, kind of nagging at you with Discovery, have you been able to enjoy the show, or have you found it more of a frustrating experience?
You know, I think each individual episode makes me waffle back and forth. I guess season 3 has really brought this into focus for me, is that every time I watch an episode of Discovery, I have to decide where on the slider from this is Star Trek to this is not Star Trek is. On the one hand, can't help it. They're talking about, you know, phasers and warp drives and shields and hailing frequencies. And, you know, that like just stimulates the lizard part of my brain, and I can't help that. But the rest of it kind of go, what is this? This makes no sense to me, in that there are ways, you know, if you're going to dive into an established continuity, if you're going to dive into philosophies that have been worked over for 50 years at this point, I'm, you know, it's like listening to a symphony and all of a sudden you're starting to hear a new movement of that symphony with discordant notes mixed in. It's still the same music, but you're going, it doesn't sound right to me. And that was kind of the ongoing issue I had from just an overview of the first two seasons. I got to say, it's been a bit of a change in season 3.
Well, I'll spill the beans for you. You weren't listening in on us when we recorded our initial thoughts on this episode. Cam and I, we had a lot of issues with Scavengers. I don't want to influence what your thoughts might be, but what's your initial take on this episode of Star Trek Discovery?
Well, as I said, so the first few episodes of the season, the first time I've gone, oh, this is 20% of a Star Trek show. Oh, this episode is 30% Star Trek. It kind of hit its high water mark already, and I had real issues with Scavengers in that it did a lot of things that other Star Trek episodes have done. It didn't do quite as well. The fan service, I gotta say, was some of it was awesome and some of it was terrible. But overall, I mean, the fundamental flaws in the show's DNA are still and are actually highlighted here in Scavengers. For example, why do you keep telling me that Michael Burnham is the most awesome, wonderful person in the universe that everybody loves? You haven't shown it to me. Sonequa Martin-Green may be luminous and a mind-blowingly good actor, but that's about the only reason the show works at all, because you haven't shown me why she's special. Sorry.
It's another issue with, say, the burn is we're kept being told that the burn is incredibly important. The burn. But they haven't really established why it is of such a degree of importance as well. And Cam and I, we've discussed it a lot. It's like Discovery has a show versus tell problem that has been there since the beginning.
Absolutely. And, you know, in my notes here on this episode, I wrote down, so it's been 130 years since the burn, and only now has someone figured out that there was a propagation wave to it, that it started in one spot and radiated outwards. That seems like the kind of thing that any previous Starfleet crew that we've seen would have done as one of their first things that they did. Let's run down to stellar cartography and figure out if this came from anywhere.
Well, you did notice that when she asked Book about the burn, he just kind of shrugged his shoulders. I don't know if they really care that much at this point.
Right. I'm thinking but still, I mean, Starfleet still seems to be a functional, well, so far seems to be a functional organization. It seems to me that making sure that this doesn't happen again should be pretty high on their tactical priorities. But I don't know. Maybe there's a reason. Let's give them some credit. Maybe there's a reason behind all this.
Now, what have you thought of the new Federation and Starfleet that we've experienced here? Is it working for you? Are we in a place where the storytelling interests you in terms of what we're seeing of Starfleet?
It does. And that's one of the things I'm kind of interested in, because there's a little things that they're doing that they're getting right. And that's enough to keep me engaged. For one thing, for example, in Scavengers, although Michael Burnham went off and went rogue and all that, they didn't dismiss what she brought them in terms of information, which is a very Starfleet thing to do. Sure, you shouldn't have done this, but just because you did it wrong, that doesn't mean we're just going to dismiss what you found, for example. I like that every time they're talking about missions, it's humanitarian. We got to help these folks. We've got to negotiate this. We've got to bring these folks replicator. Like, they're making a real effort to show that Starfleet continues to be a humanitarian organization. I'm very curious about if they're going to dive into the civilian government of the Federation and who's running that, because certainly David Cronenberg is an indication that there are still elements that are not as sunlit and, blue skies as Starfleet is supposed to be.
How dare you associate David Cronenberg with any of those things that you just said right now?
The man's a walking sepulcher, okay? He looks like a gravestone brought to life.
I don't know. He seemed pretty trustworthy when he visited space last time in Jason X.
Yeah, fair enough. But, I mean, for goodness sake, he broke the Terran Empress. Literally, he caused, she started to have blue screens of death after he talked to her for 10 minutes. So something to keep an eye on. How far does that part of Starfleet run? How deep does it run? Is it running things, for example?
Well, you bring up the civilian government, and I'm also very curious about that, because as you go through Star Trek, throughout its run, you always get the sense that Starfleet thinks that the civilians and those in charge of the Federation are kind of dummies, and the writers never really kind of mitigate that. There's always a kind of authoritarian bent to the Star Trek universe and deference towards Starfleet. If they're kind of too combined into this one headquarters, I wonder what the implications are for, that civilian versus semi-military or, I guess, paramilitary, authority there.
You're absolutely right. I think I would, however, take exception. President, I think it's Ellenshaw. God, I hope I got that right. From Star Trek IV, that man was in charge. All right. He was telling the Admiralty what to do. But after that, every subsequent Federation president we've seen has been of a bit of a pushover. You're right. And it'd be interesting to see if the Federation itself is basically a rump fiction kind of for cosmetic, purposes and Starfleet running the show, or if there really is a whole other side to that. And it would be interesting to see if they brought it up already when they arrived. I'd like to see if that's explored a little. Otherwise, it's just a throwaway line and hanging fire like so much of Discovery.
Yeah, what is your take on this show's reliance on mysteries? I mean, this sort of leap towards, I guess, modern TV, does the mystery thing work for you, or do you find it more frustrating?
Well, I mean, as long as Saru doesn't turn around and say, actually, my name is Khan, I think I'll be fine with it.
That would be amazing.
That would be amazing. I take it back. And just that would be awesome. But again, mystery for its own sake is always, it's like a parlor trick, right? And at the end of the day, if you're not ready to pay it off properly, the audience isn't going to forgive you. They're just not. And, you know, I found that, for example, season two, mystery. I'm not even sure that they paid that off properly. There are things that haven't been explained yet for that. And I hope they have a plan, because otherwise it's just, it gets frustrating. Well, just lay it out. Is there any reason why we shouldn't know this stuff?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. What species or what civilizations do you think, you know, we should be, you know, checking in on 1,000 years in the future that you would be interested in seeing where they are right now?
Well, first of all, ooh, I was so excited to see that there was a Cardassian Starfleet officer in that briefing scene. That was cool. I'm also really excited that next week's episode is called Unification 3, and the preview definitely had them doing, to answer your question directly, doing exactly what I want, which is, well, let's check in with the founders. Why are the Andorians, who are founding members of the Federation, no longer helping? You know, what's going on with the Vulcans? If you want to use them, great. I'd like to see what's going on with the Tellarites. And of course, it'd be very interesting to see what the Klingons look like 1,000 years from now as well. It seemed to me like the Romulans, basically, we know that they're pretty much out of the, you know, out of the equation at this point. And as it, you know, so basically, I'd like to check in with some old friends. I'd like to see 1,000 years from now, the Federation has fallen apart. What about the stalwarts, the ones who were there at the beginning, the ones who forged the original alliance that became the Federation? You know, what's going on with them?
Rigelian action. That's all I can hope for.
Right on.
I'm just curious, you know, kind of jumping off of Discovery, what were your thoughts on, you know, Picard or Lower Decks? I'm assuming you probably watched them.
Oh, for sure. So I thought Picard, unfortunately, except for occasional bright patches, was just an absolute flaming bag of hot garbage. And it drove me crazy. I was so excited. I came into it with all the goodwill in the universe. And I you know, basically I think they really dropped the ball, and that would take a long time to get into. I was, by the end of it, I was just so frustrated at the missed opportunity. Lower Decks started off a little rough. I maintain that the last two episodes of the first season of Lower Decks are some of the best Star Trek I've seen in 25 years.
Stefan, can I ask you a favor? Stop reading our minds at this point, because it's getting a little embarrassing right now.
Oh, sorry, but like I said, guys, sometimes you just vibe with guys. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah, I get it. No, but Cam and I, we have essentially the same thoughts about Lower Decks and Picard as you do. So just interesting. We're all kind of on the same page. And I don't want to be as if, you know, kind of these reactionary things about it's just not, you know, real Star Trek. But I think there are some legit concerns that fans are raising. And I think Lower Decks, it succeeds where, say, Picard had failed. And at points, Discovery seems to be failing.
Yeah, I think what makes Lower Decks so successful is that it finds a way to laugh with, not laugh at. That's really, you know, if you're going to do that, and they did that properly, it's easy to laugh at Star Trek. Look at those guys with the funny foreheads. Look at the weird ears. Look at the giant green space hand. Oh, look, Lincoln is on the bridge. It's easy to laugh at Star Trek. It is much more of a delicate dance to laugh with Star Trek and to, you know, to make jokes about being a Chadich and making, and frankly, just some of the background gags. But the point is, although it started a little jokey and a little rough, by the end, it was in its own groove. And frankly, although it's funny and interesting, I've heard it said Star Trek is a place. You can tell lots of different stories in that place. And I think Lower Decks did a great job by the end of finding its voice, finding a tone. If you don't like it, that's fine. But it really does adhere to the spirit of human. They never act like non-Starfleet officers, except for the one guy who got, you know, blown out an airlock for his incompetence. Everybody else might be weird and funny, but they love what they're doing and they're good at what they do. They just also make jokes. They also get into funny situations.
Steph, as we wrap up here, can I ask you to mention maybe something that you did like about Scavengers this past week?
There's actually quite a bit that, as I said, everything has high points. I love the fact that we're seeing things like, you know, mentions of a Cardassian Starfleet officer who was there. I think the retrofit of the Discovery is something I could talk for 15 minutes on, just on some of the neat ideas that are in there. I think that was great. Adding the A to the registry was neat. I do like the fact that there are serious consequences to going rogue in Discovery at this point. I, you know, normally I don't know if just being demoted to science officer is enough of a punishment, but what the heck? I mean, goodness knows Kirk got off the hook enough times. You know, I really enjoyed the fact that the action is well directed. I didn't feel like I was overwhelmed visually, as I can often be with Discovery. I frankly think that the chemistry between Book and Burnham is fantastic. And I think that I feel really bad because I have a feeling Saru is not long for the captain's chair or perhaps even this world. And oh, finally, I thought that the relationship that's being sort of started here between Stamets and Adira was just charming.
Well, Steph, before we let you go, did you happen to watch The Mandalorian this past week?
As a matter of fact, I did.
Cam, do we want to invite Steph onto the Mandalorian Report beginning now?
Sure, I'm not going to come up with a new name for it, but yeah, I think we can do the Cam DeLorton, yeah.
Cam DeLorton Report, yeah. So why don't we segue over to the Cam DeLorton Report. This is the episode The Siege. Cam, my initial thought was, A, give Mando a straw. Like, that's all he really needs at this point. And B, what if this was the Bill Barr episode, but all the novelty is gone?
Whoa, hot take.
That's cold, Obi-Wan.
I mean, I just watched this one, and I kind of sat there saying, like, okay, action sequence, action sequence, action sequence. I'd much rather just kind of have them walking around Navarro, just chilling. And I'm at the point where the series is getting a little bit more repetitive. It's like, yes, let's bring up another hologram where we point to where one base is on a planet, and here's the other base, and now you have your mission. And I was listening to the Watch podcast earlier this week, and they were doing last week's episode review, and they're just kind of, you know, comparing this series to a video game. And I was like, yes, it does feel very much kind of like those mission-oriented video games as opposed to maybe kind of the open world video game, so to speak. But that's my initial hot take. Cam, I'll throw it over to you, and then we'll get Steph's thoughts too.
Yeah, I enjoyed this episode. I agree. It's not like, in terms of storytelling, one of the greats. It's not as character-driven. But honestly, as an action-adventure episode, I thought this was really strong. And directed by Carl Weathers, I was like, where has this man been? Like, why is this man not directing more action television? Because we have, you know, a whole sequence there with an Imperial transport outrunning speeder bikes and then TIE fighters. And I'm watching the sequence going, this is more exciting than almost all of the action in Rise of the Skywalker. Like, how is this even possible?
And I just want to correct myself. I said Bill Barr. No, it's not actually. Yeah, it was Bill Burr. I've got way too much U.S. politics on my mind right now.
Right.
No, I agree. When I saw Carl Weathers was the director of that, I was just like, wowzers, that's pretty impressive. But Steph, what was your initial take on this one?
I just want to start by mentioning, you know, Carl Weathers has been directing TV for 20 years, including the episodes of Silk Stockings. So, you know, the guy's been behind the camera a little bit.
Do you want to join us on our Silk Stockings podcast as well?
You know, I got to say, I'd have to do a rewatch. It's been a while. I'm not sure if I remember the subtle dynamics and interplay between the characters. I think need to immerse myself again. But sure. I would say it's funny. I said the same thing out loud while I was watching it. I said, I'm watching a Dark Forces level. This is a Dark Forces. Cool. Which was a video game from the early 90s, probably one of the best Star Wars video games ever. It was the first Star Wars first-person shooters, same generation as the original Doom, and it was great. It was an amazing game, and this felt exactly like that. Running through gray corridors with blinking lights, shooting stormtroopers. So you can't fault that. I would also say this smells to me like a backdoor pilot. Look at that. We're about two acts into the episode, and our main character is off screen now. Goodbye. See you later. Now, how do we like Griff and Carob by themselves? Do we like them, everybody? Do we like Horatio Sands in Blueface? Are we happy with this? Because if you like this section, you know, we could do a whole show like this, just saying. Oh, and then we'll get back to the Mando, and, you know, we'll move on to the second part of the season. That's how it felt.
Does this work as a potential spinoff? Did the elements where we're not focused on Mando, did they work for you throughout this?
You know, I'm gonna defer to Cam's opinion. I thought the action looked great. I thought that, you know, Carl Weathers is fun to watch. Horatio Sands was fun to watch. Gina Carano is inexperienced but may develop. But I didn't know. I don't know. I don't think I'm chomping at the bit to watch them pacify the rest of the planet.
I just don't know if as actors they're leading kind of actors. I mean, Carl Weathers has starred in some movies, you know, Action Jackson, Hurricane Smith, but I don't know that those two characters have enough of a spark to them to lead a show, but I would be totally game for if they did, you know, produce another Star Wars TV show set in this timeline or near, you know, about this timeline, of having those characters cross over. I think that could be really interesting.
Yeah, plenty of rumors flying around that that's what they're looking at. I mean, again, who knows? Maybe last week's Mandalorians, that in itself probably, you know, support a series.
I could buy that.
And there was some interesting little nods here. Fans who are into the expanded universe were probably really excited to see Dark Troopers show up at the end of this episode. I'm not well-versed enough in expanded universe. And that's the thing with Star Wars in terms of what they're doing now. So much of it is based on expanded universe versus, say, with Star Trek, where you can go, well, this is from one of those past 700 episodes of Star Trek. With Star Wars, so much of it now is from these novels and comic books that are just outside of the wealth of knowledge so many fans have. So I'm excited to see what Dark Troopers do on this show. But, you know, I thought this was a solid episode, and I did like that they worked in a lot of backstory in terms of the sequel trilogy as well, in terms of the cloning, maybe some Snoke bodies.
Yeah, so is that what do you guys think? Is that Snoke in the tanks? Is that a proto-Snoke, or is it a red herring? I'd like to hear what you guys think.
I just wish they'd forget about Snoke clones, like, once and for all. Like, I never need to revisit
Why
that.
Why, I am inside your head. Oh, damn it. I've got to get some tea, but I'm inside your head. Yes, I'll be there in a minute.
He's not very exciting. Andy Serkis did a great job with him, though.
I just think they want to work in some backstory as to the Emperor's rebirth. I think they just want to kind of work that in there.
I just don't think they're ever going to fix the problems that were, you know, Rise of Skywalker.
No, that's not possible.
No.
That's a whole other report.
Okay, well, Steph, thank you so much for lending your thoughts on both Scavengers as well as The Siege.
Well, thank you so much for having me, guys. It was a real pleasure to get into it with you. I hope we can do this again sometime.
So, Tyler, just before we sign off, I just want to mention one thing. Earlier in the show, I talked about how... you know, is Star Trek trying to create its own Sinister Six with its villains? And it's going to kill me if I don't mention that Alex Kurtzman co-wrote Amazing Spider-Man 2, so maybe he's trying to correct his past sins. But
like I said, give me Paul Giamatti in the Rhino suit, and I'm down to see him make a crossover appearance in the Burn story arc.
For sure. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Well, I think Steph already spoiled it by saying that next week's episode is Unification 3 of Star Trek Discovery. I am intrigued by that episode title for the reason that Steph outlined there. So it should be an interesting one, or also grave, grave disappointment.
Okay, you can of course find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Vance, not big on Renegade Missions, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Neurogel will never replace Decon Gel, in my opinion. Steph, where can we find you on Twitter?
Right now, everyone can find me at Big Swing Daddy, swing like the music, not like the swapping.
Excellent.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.